Thank you, Brother George. Dear brethren, it's a great privilege for me to be here with you. It was a great privilege to receive your invitation, but also it was a great privilege with the help of our Heavenly Father to be able to accept this invitation. And I bring you Christian love from my family, from our home Ecclesia in Ludwigshafen in Germany, and from all brethren from old Europe, from Southwest Germany. There are not too many of us in that region, but we try as much as possible to serve God. Thankfully, the modern communications technology makes it possible to maintain broad contacts with all the other brethren who live in the farthest corners of the earth, just as they lived right around the corner. Despite all this, however, we lack numerous and active fellowship like the one you have here in Chicago. Incidentally, I cannot fail to mention that it was your ecclesia and some very special of your members were instrumental in my conversion almost 25 years ago when I came to Chicago, a young man looking for a place in this world, and it turned out I did find the place in your midst and at the feet of Jesus Christ. And I will always remember that, and I constantly and thankfully make mention of you in my prayers. And one more word of thanks, Brother George mentioned that already. Last year, by the Lord's grace, we were able to successfully complete the work of concordance of the Hebrew and Aramaic words of Old Testament. However, we were not able to carry the financial burden of publishing this work, and once again, your helpful ecclesia came to the rescue, and it's a great privilege to have such friends. I know that our thanks for all good gifts are due first of all to the Most High, but He uses His skillful vessels to bring His help. May the Eternal One be praised for giving us this wonderful fellowship in the truth and in His Son. But let us move along to the subject of our lesson, which is Noah's Ark. Perhaps it may seem that the topic is not deep enough to be worth of consideration for the deep Bible study. But we find, however, some arguments which support to study the story of the flood. Firstly, much room is devoted to it in the scriptures. The breadth of this coverage makes us think that it was an important event worthy of our consideration. Secondly, perhaps no other biblical event is so well dated. We found in Bible around 45 events that are dated down to a year, month, and a day. Out of those, 5 or more than 10% are associated with the flood. Thirdly, many heathen mythologies contain traces of the flood. And this may not be a binding argument, but it also proves that it's a worthy thing to study this event. And fourthly, the flood, as it were, a new beginning of mankind's existence. We had a beginning in Adam, but we know we are all, as well, children of Noah. But our topic will not be so much the flood as the ark, the wooden structure, which saved the lives of Noah and his family. A short description of the structure of the ark is found in Genesis 6, 14 through 16. Make thee an ark of gopher wood, rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shall pitch it within and without with pitch. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height of it 30 cubits. A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above. And the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with lower, second, and third stories shalt thou make it. From a further description in Genesis 8:13, we also learn that the ark had some sort of covering which was removed after the ground dried up. And we read, "And Noah removed the covering of the ark." The dimensions given were 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. 300 cubits is approximately 500 feet. If we realize that the biggest aircraft carrier is 1,000 feet long, it would make the ark half its length. And it was made out of wood and using hand labor and hand tools. The ark had three floors divided into enclosures. There was a window at the top of the ark with an intriguing measure of 1 cubit. And on the side of it there was a door. The ark was made of gopher wood. It is traditionally believed that cedar is meant here, but the Hebrew word gopher occurs only in this account. It is difficult to accurately define its meaning. The wood was to be made leak-proof with tar, the name of which is kofar in Hebrew. And this name differs from the name of the wood by just one initial letter, quite similar to it phonetically. It's G, ga, and K, kofar. Perhaps that is why some translate the word kofar as resin, gum tree. Additionally, traditionally, we picture the ark shaped as a giant nutshell, narrow at the bottom and wider at the top to increase the vessel's displacement. Assuming this was the way it was built would require unusual skill on Noah's part. True, we don't know how well the civilization was developed before the flood, and we do know that God's power can perform miracles. Yet, it does seem that the structure of the ark had to be simpler than that in view of its sheer size. The intriguing description of the window structure may help us to better picture the shape of the ark. The Hebrew word for window is halon. That is also the word used in reference to the window in the ark in Genesis 8:6. Noah opened the window, halon, of the ark which he had made. But in the account of the ark's construction, another word is used, zohar. And that word is, in other contexts, denotes noon, and the time of the day when the sun is in the zenith. Some translate this word as light or a transparent roof. The zohar was to be in a cubit finished above, Genesis 6:16. This expression is also explained in different ways. Most translators tend to agree that a cubit was a width of the opening. Others say that it was the distance from the window to the roof. The expression finished above, in connection with the specific name of the window, zohar, noon, suggests one more thought which most of Jewish commentaries side with. Namely, they believe that the cross-section of the ark was a triangle with a base of 50 cubits and the height of 30 cubits with a missing top, which is where the zohar window was placed. Pointing vertically upwards toward the sun at the zenith. This direction of the window helps to explain the necessity of sending out birds to see if the land has dried off. For if the window was on the side, just like the door, they could confirm the condition of the earth by looking out. With this basic understanding of the shape of the ark, we will try to establish one more geometrical aspect. As the rain started coming down and the earth was gradually filled with waters, the ark was carried by the water and floated partially submersed. In Genesis 7:20, we read, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. We learn here that the waters topped the highest mountains by 15 cubits, the mountains being perhaps the range of Ararat, where the ark later rested. This would mean that the submerged portion of the 30 cubits of the ark's total height could not have exceeded 15 cubits, or else the ark would not have been able to freely float over top of the highest mountains. After the water started subsiding, the bottom of the ark touched the peak of the mountain and then gradually emerged out of the water. We will try to see whether the chronological description of the flood gives us an insight into how deep the ark was submerged and whether these numbers can contribute anything to the symbolic meaning of the story in addition to external dimensions. The chronology of the flood is a question widely disputed. The Bible accounts give 5 dates and 6 references to time periods. Many possibilities are given as to reconciling these periods. We will list these time references from the account, mentioning the biggest issues in their reconciliation, and we will choose one proposed explanation that appears the most correct and the most meaningful in interpretation. First, let's quickly summarize the events described in the account of the flood. In Genesis 7:4, God declares that in 7 days he would cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. This commences in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month. From that day forward, it rains continually for 40 days and 40 nights. And the waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. The water decreased, and on the 17th day of the seventh month, the ark rests on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continue to drain until the first day of the 10th month, and then the peaks of the mountains appear. From that point, Noah waits 40 days, opens a window, and sends out a raven. The raven returns to the ark, not having found a shelter. It is not said how long Noah waited before sending forth a dove, but we can infer from the words, "And he stayed yet other 7 days, and again he sent forth a dove," that since from the first sending out of the dove to the second one was another 7 days, then from the sending out of the raven to the first sending of the dove was also 7 days. This first dove returns just like the raven, without a sign of the earth drying off. The dove sent out the second time returns with an olive leaf. Then Noah waits another 7 days and again sends out the dove, and it does not return to the ark. On that day, on the first day of the first month of the 601st year of Noah's life, he removes the covering from the ark and sees that the face of the earth, which before has been covered with water, can now be seen. On 27th day of the second month, the earth completely dries off, and Noah with his family and the animals leave the ark. This is the end of the flood, and it takes place after 12 months and 10 days spent in the ark. The following time references are mentioned in this account, 5, and we notice that only with 2 of those of the above dates, the year of Noah's life is mentioned, and the following time periods are mentioned, and we can add to this list another 7 days, which we assume had passed from the sending forth of the raven to the first sending forth of the dove. The time measurements used in the flood account year. In Genesis 7:6 tells us that Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. As it relates to count of years in this account, it is certain that what is meant is not the year elapsed from Noah's birth date, but a calendar year reckoned from spring or from fall. In our consideration, it will be sufficient to number the months sequentially in the year of Noah's life without assigning their specific Hebrew names or season of the year. Month. It is quite commonly understood that months used in the flood account are lunar months. We would agree with this view based on the argument that God created the lights and the firmament to be for signs of time, Genesis 1:14. And the time from one new moon to the next has from the most ancient times been recognized at the length of 1 month by almost all cultures. The Hebrew word Chodesh, used to denote a month, also in our account, actually means a new moon. In connection with this, with the scriptural flood account, there is a lively dispute regarding the length of the lunar month. Astronomy tells us that the rotation of the moon around the earth takes 29 and a half days, and that this duration has not changed over the last 600,000 years. The practical implication is that the lunar months would have to be alternately 29, 30 days in order for the first day of the month to always coincide with a new moon. History tells us that all other ways of month calculation were used in Egypt, for example, to synchronize the lunar year with the solar year. All months were 30 days long, and at the end of the year, they added 5 days. Some Bible interpreters tend to support this length of the month. We will, however, use the natural lunar month from the new moon to a new moon, or 29 and a half days. The greatest problem in establishing the chronology, we need the next slide. The greatest problem in establishing the chronology of the flood is, one, the relationship of the time of 150 days when the waters prevailed upon the earth with the date of the 17th day of the 7th month. This is a question. And the relationship of the date of the first day of the 10th month when the tops of the mountains were seen with the date when the earth dried. Problem one. A large number of commentators of this account tend to agree that the 40 days of the rain is a part of 150 days of the time when the waters prevailed on the earth. It would appear to be an obvious conclusion because from 17th day of the 2nd month to the 17th day of 7th month is exactly 5 months. But this view presents two fundamental problems. The time from 17th day of the 2nd month to the 17th day of 7th month counted by the new moons would not be 150 days, but 147 and a half days, since the new moons are not 30, but 29 and a half days apart. Thus, assuming that in this account we are dealing with a lunar month, the time from 17th day of the 2nd month to the 17th day of the 7th month is too short to be the same as the time of the waters prevailing upon the earth. What's more, this interpretation contradicts the natural rhythm of the account of the flood. The Bible tells us that it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and then that the waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. We need to bear in mind that the flood waters were from two sources, from the windows of heaven and from the fountains of the great deep, Genesis 7:11. After 40 days, the rain stopped, but the water did not decrease. Only after some time did God send forth a wind, which is written in Genesis 8:1, which caused the water to subside. Genesis 8:3 reads, "And the waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of the 150 days, the waters were abated." This suggests that the waters started to subside only after the 150 days when the fountains of the Great Deep were closed. And if the bottom of the ark floated freely over the highest mountain peaks, then it must have touched the ground well into the period of the decrease of the waters. And that very point is marked as the 17th day of the 7th month. However, in this approach to the chronology of event, a problem appears. 40 days of rain added to 150 days of the waters prevailing added still to sometimes of the waters decreasing after the 150 days gives some 200 plus days, or approximately 7 months, and not 5, as it would appear based on the dates mentioned in the account. However, the date in Genesis 8:4, as we already mentioned, is not accompanied by the date of the Noah's life. One can think then that the 7th month and at this point is not the 7th sequential month in the year of the life of Noah, but the 7th month from the time when the rain stopped, since the flood began in the 2nd month and the rain persisted for 40 days, then the first month in this reckoning is the 3rd sequential month, and the date of 7 months later falls on the 9th sequential month. So the date from Genesis 8:4 in terms of the month of Noah's life should be seen as the 17th day of the 9th month. It was the day when the ark rested on the top of the mountains of Ararat. To determine the point of time at which the water started to decrease after 40 days of the rain and the 150 days of waters prevailing, the sum of 190 days should be divided into 29.5 days, which results in 6 months and 13 days. The flood started on 17th day of the 2nd month. After 6 months and 13 days from the date, it was the first day of the 9th month. From that time, the water started to subside, and after 16 days, on the 17th day of the 9th month, the ark rested on the top of the mountain. Thus, we can discern that it's not directly stated, what is not directly stated in the account, the time of the waters subsiding from the highest level to the level when the bottom of the ark touched the peak of the highest mountain. We will do it later. Problem 2. The next date given in the account is the first day of the 10th month, Genesis 8:5, when the tops of the mountains could be seen. Because 15 cubits of water were covering the highest mountains, then in that day the water level was 15 cubits below the highest level. This date is based calculated by counting backwards from the date given in Genesis 8:12, 13. We read, "And he stayed yet other 7 days and sent forth the dove, which returned not again unto him anymore. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of ground was dry." It seems clear that Noah removed the covering of the ark on the same day when the dove did not return to him, recognizing that the ground must be dry. And the dove, which a week earlier had found a green leaf, now has found a dry place on the ground where to build its nest. Noah sent forth the birds 4 times in weekly intervals. Thus, the sending forth of the birds took 20 days. Then, prior to that, still 40 days elapsed from the appearing of the tops of the mountains to the first bird being sent out. In the 10th month of the first day of the month, were the tops of the mountains seen, and it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and he sent forth a raven. Genesis 8, 5 through 7. This means that from the appearing of the mountain tops to the first day of the first month of the 601st year of Noah's life was exactly 60 days, or 2 months. Thus, the 10th month of Genesis 8:5 cannot be the 10th sequential month in the year, but the 10th month from the beginning of the flood in the second month. Jewish scholar Rashi and many other Jewish commentators after him relate to the length of the 10th month is counted from the second month, and that it ends at the date of the first day of the 11th month in the year. Summarizing, the hardest part is we have already. Summarizing all the above calculation, we got the following chronology of the flood with all the dates expressed in terms of sequential month from the beginning of the year. It would take too long to read this diagram. You will find it maybe someday later in internet, or you can receive the copy. From this set of chronological point, we can now calculate the missing dimension of the structure of the ark, the depth of its submersion. The waters began to subside on the first day of the 9th month, and after 60 days, on the first day of the 9th month, the tops of the mountains appeared. The highest level of the waters was 15 cubits above the mountain tops. This means that the water level subsided at the rate of 1 cubit per 4 days. In the first period, the bottom of the ark touched the earth's surface after 16 days. This means that it was period to the bottom of the ark touched the earth's surface after. This means it was floating a mere 4 cubits above. The ark was floating 4 cubits above the mountaintops. Then, during the next 44 days, the water subsided 11 more cubits, and then the tops of the mountains could be seen, including that where the ark was resting. This means that the ark was submerged 11 cubits, and the remaining 19 cubits were above the water surface. Additionally, from the rate at which the water level was lowering, it can be inferred that the Earth's surface, which dried off by the first day of the first month of the 601, was only 15 cubits below the top of the mountain where the ark rested. This means that the highest point at the top of the ark in its highest elevation was 15 plus 4 plus 11 plus 19, that is 49 cubits above the earth's surface. And the 50th cubit was the top taken off of the pyramid. Whereas at the point of the meeting of the ark with the ground, the water still was still covering 11 cubits of the ark, ark submersion, and 15 cubits of the height of the mountain where ark rested. Let us make an attempt to interpret the symbolic meanings of the discovered details of the ark. As a basis to the symbolic interpretation of the ark and its account, let us use the declaration of the Apostle Peter in his first epistle. While the ark was a preparing, wherein few, that is 8 souls, were saved by water, the like figure whereunto even baptism doth, Also now save us, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of the good conscience toward God, by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. 1 Peter 3:20-21. So the ark is a picture of baptism. It saves our lives, which could have been lost if not for the miraculous possibility of the answer of a good conscience towards God. The Hebrew term for the ark, teba, outside of the flood account, is found only two more times denotes a basket made out of the bulrushes which Jochebed hid the little Moses. She took for him an ark, teba, of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein. Exodus 2:1. Also in this case, the ark, covered with tar, saved in the water the life of the future deliverer of Israel. We will remember this analogy with Moses' life because we will mention him a few more times in our lesson. The ark was built of the gopher wood and leak-proofed with a gopher resin. The second word signifies resin or a leak-proof layer only in this occurrence. By reason of its etymology, all other occurrences mean ransom. Also, the verb used in Genesis 6:14 to denote the action of covering with pitch is quite popular, and in many other places it means to accomplish atonement. These words result from the original meaning of the stem kafar, which means to cover. As example, we will quote one scripture with a noun, kafar, and the verb kafar. Deliver him from going down to the pit, I have found a ransom, which is kafar, the same word as resin. And Aaron shall offer his bullock of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make an atonement, kafar, for himself, and for his house, to cover, make an atonement. The tree, which we associate with the resin called kafar, could mean the cross, on which the ransom was given. Hence, perhaps, the related names of both materials of which the ark was made. The baptism means to the followers of Jesus the taking up of the cross and suffering with the Lord. Just like the ark, without being made watertight by using the resin, so the suffering of our own cross would be ineffective without the covering of Jesus' ransom. The ark had the sohar, window, an opening, a light at zenith, which was directed straight at the heavens. The sohar ensured the light from God and gave the ability to look up into the heavens, from which at first proceeded the drenching rain of God's wrath. Then, through the Sohar, the stars and the moon could be seen, which marked the duration of the months. The Sohar did not ensure the possibility of the direct viewing of the world to which Noah and his family were being carried. Yet, through this window, they could send forth birds which would bring back the news from the new world. In our baptism, which also transports us to another world, there is also the Zohar of prayer, our contact with the invisible world. Firstly, we can look to God through it, and he gives us light and the necessary information about time. Secondly, through this window, we can send forth the birds of our prayers. God's answer are like the dove, returning with an olive leaf in her beak. The ark was constructed on ground level, and the flood transported it on the highest mountain. It was not a gradually ascending path. The ark's elevation was rising first for 40 days and then remain floating at the same level for 150 days, touching the 50th cubit of eternity with its missing top. And then it slowly started to descend as the waters subsided. After 16 days, it gently touched the mountaintop, but as the waters decreased, there must have been a friction felt, a slanted position, and perhaps structural cracks. The first 40 days of baptism transport the believer into a wilderness. We remember the path of the Lord after his baptism. He went into the wilderness to meditate in solitude upon his mission to the world, his death, and his resurrection. Other men of God also had similar experiences. We recall the 40 days that Moses spent on the mountain, receiving from God his law for mankind. In the lives of both these men, Jesus and Moses, there was still another 40 days period. Moses ascended to the mountain again to receive new tablet, to replace those he broke for the first time. Jesus spent 40 days after his resurrection on the earth before he ascended to heaven. Also in the flood account, we see a second period of 40 days which elapsed from the emergence of the mountaintops till the sending out of the raven. A wilderness does not evoke an association with water. However, if we consider the basic characteristics of the wilderness from a prophetic point of view, a complete reliance upon God, then it appears that the earth covered up to its horizon with likely salt waters creates similar conditions. Castaways perish at sea just like people in the desert, firstly and foremostly due to lack of water. After the 40 days of the wilderness, there is a period of 150 days when the consecrated touches the heaven. This is beautifully shown in the Apostle Paul's life. After his conversion, he had the period of the symbolic 40 days in the wilderness. We read in Galatians 1:16-17. Immediately, I conferred not with flesh and blood, but I went to Arabia, to be followed later with his rewarding years in Tarsus, during which he received many visions. And we read in 2 Corinthians 12:2, I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, such an one caught up to the third heaven. After the period of spiritual rising, detachment from the earth, and a complete reliance of God's power, the ark of the baptism begins to slowly descend in order to meet with the ground. After the period of rising, there is a slow descent. Sometimes we may describe this state as a cooling off of the first love, but it is a rather different thing. God, who for a while lifted us up closer to heavens, now is setting our feet on the ground. The slow impact of the ark and the mountain, the collision of our baptism with the earth, is not always free of thumps, loss of balance, or even small damage. The moment of the 17th day of the 7th month has a special meaning to a consecrated person. It is then that he or she stands on the first trial of putting in practice the truth that he has been learned and consecrated. The ark was 30 cubits high, 300 cubits long, and 50 cubits bright. In Hebrew, the letters are also used as numbers. In this case, 30 is L, 300 is Sh, and 50 is N. These letters make up the word Lashon, which means language in Hebrew. The ark, in the case of both Noah and Moses, kept safe for the generation to come the person who would be able to communicate to history the message about the past and about God, the creator and the maker of the future. So it is with the consecrated through baptism. It is their goal to preserve the word, begotten with the word of truth, James 1:18. During the symbolic 150 days of prevailing in the word, they build up their knowledge, rejoice in the learning of a new, beloved purpose of life. This was probably the experience of most of us. After the period of wilderness, starved for knowledge, we devoured the word. But after the 150 days, the water begins to decrease, and the Lord carefully sets our feet on the earth and puts our knowledge of the truth face to face with life. This stage begins after 16 days of the subsiding of the water. During that time, the water level went down by 4 cubits. The rate of 1 cubit per 4 days is reflected in several other proportions particular to this picture. At school, we learned that the chemical symbol for water is H2O, which signifies 2 atoms of hydrogen and 1 of oxygen. Hydrogen is an element as an element has an atomic neutral charge of 2, which means that its nucleus consists of 2 particles, and oxygen's atomic neutral charge is 16, meaning the number of particles making up its nucleus. This means that the weight proportion of oxygen and hydrogen in water are 4 to 1. In this first description of Eden in Genesis 2:6, we are told that the water was water. We are told that the ground was watered by mist. This was as if the original form of water. The word mist in Hebrew is ad, and is written by means of 2 letters, aleph equal to 1 and dalet equal to 4. Here then we also see the ratio of 1 to 4. The flood started in the 600th year of Noah's life. Its announcement came 120 years earlier, when Noah was 480 years old. 120 in proportion to 480 is also the ratio of 1 to 4. One thumb is countered by 4 fingers of our palm. The head is placed against the remaining 4 segments of the body across the bending lines of the hips, the knees, and the ankles. This proportion shows the possibilities in practical action, which consists of the important 1 and the complementing 4. At this point, we discover some proportions implied by the depth of submersion of the ark. We remember that it was partially submerged in the water by 11 cubits for 150 days, with its top reaching to the 50th cubit of rest of the future world. Then it slowly settled on the mountain. Water covered the 15 cubits out. When it slowly settled on the mountain, water covered the 15 cubits out of the mountain's height and 11 cubits of the submersion of the ark. The sum of these 2 numbers is 26. The 4 letters contained in the name of God also have the value, total value of 26. Note also the same proportion. The first 2 of the letters, Yod and He, which makes up the shortened form of God's name, Yah, have the value of 15, while the remaining letters showing God's dimension in man, as it were, add up to 11. After this time, we begin to study the new world. Though through the opening of Zohar, which so far let in light and information from God, now we begin to send forth the birds of our prayers. In this phase of the development of our consecration, we deal with four stages of learning. The first bird that was sent out was a raven. Our first attempt and learning of God's will in action, of understanding the world to which we are being transported, are heavy and clumsy. Our prayers return to us in the same fashion as we send them. Only in the second test does the Holy Spirit accompany our prayers. The second bird is a dove, which was a symbol of the spiritual baptism of Jesus. Also, at this stage, our prayers do not bring about the desired results. Only the second sending out of the dove results in an olive leaf. Olive oil is also a symbol of the Spirit, of the peaceful answer that we receive through prayer. The fourth stage is when the dove does not return to the ark. Sometimes we think, I pray, but I receive no answer. It sometimes happens that the lack of an answer is the most wonderful information. It was clear to Noah that the dove which did not return to the window was a herald of the good news of the land having dried. When Jesus taught his apostle how to preach the gospel, he said, "And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it be not worthy, let your peace return to you." Matthew 10:13. The dove of peace sent to the worthy world will not return, as it is most precious, and it is most precious to us to know that. The mature prayers are filled with a conviction that they accomplish its purpose, which we can only guess. The same day when the dove leaves without returning, Noah takes off the cover of the ark so to enjoy the sunshine and fresh air along the entire length of the open top. Perhaps even through the narrow opening, it had been possible for him to stick out his head to see what this new world looks like. The flood waters dried up from the surface of the land. Nevertheless, he remains in the ark for 57 days more days. The stage of Christian maturity is necessary in the life of the consecrated to test their faithfulness and constancy of action. This is an advanced stage of spiritual life, and it is characterized by the certainty that God is present in our lives, and the certainty of the future world, in whose sunshine we want to warm up and in whose air we desire to breathe. Only on the 27th day of the second month, after 365 days of a full solar year, Noah leaves the ark and is capable of an independent life in God's new world. We all await this moment of change. As long as we are in this life, we await the time when we can finally leave the covering of the ransom sacrifice of Jesus' cross and continue to walk on our own. But this would be a different story, and it will take place only after the spiritual birth and the full power of maturity. Meanwhile, as we enjoy our individual abiding in the ark, we wish that the top of our ark always reaches the 50th cubit of the world to come, that our Zohar shine with a bright light, that the 1 against 4 would have the most practical dimension, that our 11 would meet with God's 15, that our doves would bring us olive leaves, or better yet, never return, so that we can, as soon as possible, remove the covering of our ark and rejoice in God's Son and heir until the time when He decides that we are ready to leave the ark of the ransom's cross. All this is my heartfelt wish to you, brethren, but the foremost wish for you is that for the removal of ark's covering. And may the Lord bless our wishes. Amen.